Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. My name is Heather Coleman. I'm the director of the Religion and Culture Program at the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies. And together with David Goa, who is the director of the Testimony Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life, we want to welcome you to evening's talk. Our speaker tonight is Father Dr. Miguel Pavone. He's a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate. He was the chair of that church's external relations department. And in that capacity, he was very active in ecumenical relations, both among the various churches in Ukraine and with the Lutheran, Anglican, Catholic, and Oriental churches abroad. He's also a teacher and a researcher in the field of patristics, church history, ecclesiology, political theology, and the sociology of religion. He has a candidate degree from the Cave Theological Academy and a PhD in theology from the University of Durham. He's the author of Will, Action, and Freedom, Christological Controversies in the 7th Century, published by Grimm in 2008. And many other publications. He taught widely in Ukraine and abroad. Most recently, he served as vice rector of the postgraduate school of the Russian Orthodox Church, and now he's the coordinator of programs in theology at the National University Cave Mogila Academy. He's currently, however, a research fellow at Yale University, where he's working on a project about the church in the public square, focusing on the patterns of behavior of the Eastern churches. And so when things began to change quite dramatically in Ukraine this winter, and the churches were very much in that public square, you must not have been able to believe your luck in that sense. And so his talk today is Maidan, the Church in the Public Square. So please welcome Father Miguel.
Thank you, Heather, for the words of the introduction. Can you hear me? No. Does it work?
It does.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the words of introduction. It is a great privilege for me to be here again. I was here last time in February and enjoyed very much the hospitality of Father Cornell and of the parish. I will be talking in English, and then we will be able to ask questions and I will answer to them in either English or Ukrainian. So I think everyone will be fine with English, right? Okay, good. Well, we can probably now, we can hardly believe that Maidan happened just 3 months ago, 2 or 3 months ago. Now it seems to be quite remote after the events that followed the invasion, the annexation of Crimea, then the dramatic developments in the eastern and southern parts of Ukraine. They have somehow overshadowed the Maidan, I think, because all of us, we live on the internet now, we read the news, we check the news every hour, and we are really concerned about what is going on in Ukraine. And now Maidan has moved maybe for some of us somewhere to the backstage. And it is good, I think, to refresh what Maidan was and what it stood for, because I think the Maidan will give meaning to many of us for a long time. And I think we need to continue judging events and developments in Ukraine with the criterion of the Maidan, especially on the eve of the presidential elections, especially given what will expect us. in what will follow the presidential elections. So the Maidan is kind of constitutes a kind of criterion of judgment, and I think it is will constitute a criterion of judgment as well. And it is important, therefore, to analyze the phenomenon of Maidan from different perspectives, including the religious one, because the Maidan in Kyiv was really not just a political or social event; it was an important religious event, an important, spiritual happening, if you wish. It is difficult to analyze what it was, given also the propaganda which tries to diminish the significance, the importance of the Maidan. And I think when Maidan is considered from the perspective of the values it stood for, when the Maidan is considered exactly from this religious perspective, then it is harder for the propaganda to diminish its meaning, its significance. Earlier today, at the presentation at the University of Alberta, I was asked. I said that Maidan was probably the most real thing in Ukraine during last years, and I was asked a question: why do I believe that Maidan was real, more real than, say, the aspirations of the Ukrainian society, than the Ukrainian government, maybe than the Ukrainian state as such? And I answered that it is more real because so many human lives were sacrificed during the Maidan. And the reality of things sometimes is measured with the blood shed for those events. And I think it was exactly the case with the Maidan that made it very much real and very much relevant to the lives of many people, to the Ukrainian people, to the Ukrainian society, because of the Heavenly Hundred who sacrificed their lives for the purposes that were not directly relevant to their, you know, just salaries, pensions and stuff. Sometimes I say that the Maidan was initially rated as Euromaidan. It stood for the European Union, for the signing association with the European Union. It stood for declared European values. Can you imagine now any European country where people would go to die for the European values? I cannot imagine it. People most in any European country would come together, to, you know, to demand more pensions and more salaries, probably not to protect European values and to die for them. And was it, however, only about the European values that appeared to be relevant mostly to Ukraine, not to any other European country? No, I don't think so. And I think it is kind of misleading to associate the Maidan only with the European choice of Ukraine, though it is associated with the European choice of Ukraine. I think Maidan has to do a lot with a new identity of Ukraine. It is really an identity building phenomenon. And what is important for us here is that the church was a very active participant in this identity building process. And that is another difference of Maidan with Europe, that in Europe the civil society was in most cases, in the case of most countries, European countries, emerged through wrestling with the church, through sometimes denying the church with a strong opposition from the church, while in Ukraine the birth of the civil society, as we can define the Maidan, happened with an active participation of the church, which means that the Ukrainian society is really very religious, and the Ukrainian society seeks help from the church in achieving what it aspires for, particularly in becoming a more fair, juster place, the place where the human dignity, human freedom can be better realized, can be better enjoyed. And the Ukrainian people, on the one hand, are extremely religious. The events of the Maidan showed that, and at the same time, Maidan showed that to be religious does not mean to be kind of retrograde, you know, kind of isolated or isolationist, group of people. People can be really advanced, can be really. Ukrainian people can be more European than many European people are, and at the same time they remain religious. So to be kind of advanced civil group is not contradictory to being religious. Something that many people maybe in Europe believe, but I think Ukraine has proved that, well, those rules don't work there. In order to explore more this aspect of the Maidan, I'd like to start with a story told by a now famous Ukrainian blogger, Olesya Mamchich. She told this story about her husband, who was captured together with other men in the winter, on one of the winter days. By Berkut, and she tells a nice story. Well, the internet, you know, all was full of such stories, and all of us, we with eager read those stories and we absorbed them, and they constituted the kind of the big narrative of the Maidan, of what Maidan was. So she wrote, a full bus of the Berkut attacked our blue Lanos, driven by Sashko. Sashko is the husband of Olesya. He was pulled out of the car, put on the ground, and beaten. Later on, together with others, he was brought somewhere nearby, I suspect the Mariinsky Park. There, though snow was falling, the earth was in the blood. They released two girls on their way, while they took the boys outerwear. Sashko had a wonderful grandfather's army coat, our family heirloom. We did not see the coat anymore, but it doesn't matter. They laid the boys in sweaters on the minus 20 degrees cold on the ground, and some put on their knees. They held them thus for up to 2 hours. Something human awakened in their soul, because on the halfway they threw on Sashko's shoulders someone else's jacket. While Sashko was on his knees on the snow, the Berkut man conducted a lesson of political information, telling their point of view on the Maidan. In particular, they were extremely interested in how much we are paid. Well, at least 200 hryvnias is for sure. They were not convinced by the answers that they were not paid, actually. And the final touch. They required from Sashko to say, glory be to the Berkut. And my husband said, glory be to everyone who has not lost conscience. This story, I think, reveals the core of the civil strife incarnate in the Maidan. People on the one side of the Kievan barricades firmly believed that social activity could be only a simulation stimulated with money, fear, or power. These values, widely admired in the post-Soviet countries, and they actually constitute the main framework of the Soviet and post-Soviet mentality, money, fear and power. And these values were confessed by the soldiers of the Berkut, and thousands, those who participated in the so-called anti-Maidans in support of Yanukovych and his regime. They supported a regime which also believed only in money, fear and power, and which actually built its power on these three values. On the other side of the barricades, people stood with resolve to die in hope that there are things that matter more than money, comfort, health, and even life. And they summarized all these values in the words conscience and dignity. In essence, the Maidan was all about dignity. It was branded as the Maidan of dignity, and I think rightly so. In the system of the political social coordinates which dominated in Ukraine in the last years, such words as dignity, justice, democracy were just words. The reality behind these words was opposite to their original meaning. Dignity, justice and democracy in this system of coordinates were imitational, not real. And this system prevailed in the majority of the former Soviet republics after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Well, the post-Soviet socio-political system is in some sense eclectic. On the one hand, it features elements of the old communist ideology and of the Soviet political traditions, and on the other hand, it has adopted many elements of the Western political systems or language. And recently this system was endowed with an ideology when kleptocracy turned to a civilizational project. The newly born neo-Soviet ideology expresses itself, unfortunately, in religious terms and resembles some sort of civil religion. This civil religion features otherwise incompatible elements of the old Russian imperial ideology, like the Third Rome, Moscow as the Third Rome, communism in its hardest Stalinist edition, unfortunately Orthodox Christianity, etc. This new ideology is called to legitimize the neo-Soviet political model and the regimes that establish themselves in the post-Soviet countries. The feature of this neo-Soviet model and the ideology that serves it is extremely attractive to the political elites because it allows them to convert extremely effectively the political power to money, to wealth. It is and therefore, when in 2009 Yanukovych won the presidential office, he became one of the zealous adherents of this model and of this new religion. As a result, he and his family turned fabulously wealthy, and we've seen all those wealths. From the reports from Mezhigirye, from his residence, one of his residences actually. As for the rest of the people, they became significantly poorer, completely dependent on those with political power and deprived of the rudiments of the social justice that they had before. However, people came to the Maidan to protest not so much personally against the president and his family, but against the system which Yanukovych supported and perfected. Maidan thus accumulated protests against the political model which became dominant in the former Soviet republics. It was essentially anti-Soviet, or better to say anti-neo-Soviet. Symbolical in this regard is that the protesters took care to pull down as many monuments to Lenin as they could. At the core of the social conflict that the Maidan embodied was therefore not so much a tension between the pro-Western and pro-Russian orientation of the country, but a tension between those who are against and those who are for the the neo-Soviet model of development of the Ukrainian nation. And we see how it continues now with the conflict in the eastern part of Ukraine, where a good deal of people who are Russian-speaking nevertheless supported the Maidan in the winter time, and they continue to support Ukraine because they believe that it is a way out of the Soviet past. While for many who support separatists and the separatists themselves, they are profoundly Soviet people with a profoundly Soviet mentality. And this is essentially the core of the conflict. On the Maidan, that continued to the conflict in the eastern part of Ukraine. Essentially, I want to say that on the Maidan, many people, if not the majority of people, were Russian-speaking people, essentially. But we faced an interesting phenomenon of a Russian-speaking Ukrainian nationalist on the Maidan. And we have the same kind of, although their cause was not so much for the nation as for the model of the society which would be free of the Soviet past, you know, of the Soviet elements. And we have the same kind of conflict between the anti-Soviet and pro-Soviet groups within the society in the east of Ukraine. And this exactly explains the aggression of Russia against Ukraine, because the Maidan has challenged the entire system model which was built by Putin, and it was a direct threat to him, to his model of power in Russia. And therefore I believe that Ukraine has a potentiality now to change not only the Ukrainian situation but also to change Russia. I've been told today also during my earlier lecture that Ukraine needs to protect itself from the influence from Russia, but I think Ukraine can achieve even more. Ukraine can eliminate the threat in the north by facilitating the change of the regime of the society, which will actually help Ukraine to develop itself without threats. The calculation of Putin in his aggression against Ukraine is based on the support of those in the country, in Ukraine, who are nostalgic about the Soviet Union and who subscribe to the values of the neo-Soviet social model. Among these values are paternalism, the cult of power, of a powerful leader, and patriotism, which with the elements of fascism, essentially. Speaking about the moral strength of the Maidan, one cannot avoid addressing the issue of violence there. And this issue of violence and far-right people like Pravi Sektor and so forth was widely discussed in the Western media and brought as a kind of argument against the moral validity, moral strength of Maidan. And I think we need to analyze this aspect. I think originally the Ukrainian protests were non-violent. I would call the Maidan a kind of a collective Gandhi that abstained from any violence at any price, even at the price of the lives of its own people. Because I think that if Maidan applied some violence at the very beginning, in the end of November, after the students were beaten on the 30th of November, given the pathological phobia of Yanukovych against Maidan, when people came in thousands to the Maidan of Nezalezhnost in Kyiv, the party of region, Yanukovych, were really afraid of this. And if Maidan applied some violence, it could overthrow easily the regime as early as in the first days of December, and we wouldn't have all this long period of, you know, of the civil conflict. We wouldn't probably have the Heavenly Hundred. But because Maidan chose on that day to remain peaceful, calm, and to avoid any kind of violence, it had to pay for this daily. And I think this proves the fundamentally peaceful character of the protesters on the Maidan, and gives much more credibility to the Maidan and to the moral constituency of the Maidan. Of course, after the so-called dictatorship laws on the 16th of January were adopted by the parliament, with the Party of Regents and the communists voting for them, people realized that they cannot just push back, and they cannot continue like that. They had to react. They had to. They had no other choice but to resist to any attempt to dissipate them. And the Maidan changed its character somehow to a more violent protest. I believe that the Maidan should not be blamed for that. I believe that those who share daily in the responsibility for Maidan turning from a peaceful manifestation to a scene of violence, a part of the regime, of course, is the inability of the opposition leaders and inability of the leaders of the EU and the US to contribute meaningfully to support the course of the Maidan. And at the latest stage of the protest, the young activists from the far right and the leftist movements demonstrated excessive violence. Some of them were provocators engaged by the regime. Some were youngsters who looked for adventure. Some were people overwhelmed by the desire of revenge after the snipers shot down dozens of the protesters. These radical groups did not nevertheless express the dominating mood of the Maidan's majority. The core of the Maidan remained peaceful and faithful to its initial values. The churches played an important role in preserving the peaceful character of the Maidan. People came to the Maidan because of the numerous abuses by the political regime, but they also felt that the regime violated something essentially human. They protested against its brutal inhumanity. Many of the protesters tried to express their feelings and dissatisfaction in religious terms. Thus, the language of dignity which the Maidan adopted became, to a great extent, religious, a language that employed religious symbols, terms, and prayers. People appealed to God's justice. They demanded the authorities to act in accordance with the commandments of God. All 3 months of the protest, the people on the Maidan began and ended their day with prayers. They kneeled right on the frozen pavers of the square, attentively listened to the scripture read to them from the scene of the Maidan and to the sermons preached to them by bishops and priests of different churches. The Maidan, a part of being a political and social event, thus became a religious phenomenon, an outstanding religious phenomenon. And probably imagine those thousands of people kneeling to pray together. It is something extraordinary. I mean, you cannot imagine a public square in many senses of this word, the public square, filled with people kneeling and praying together. That was probably the most outstanding, extraordinary manifestation of the presence of the church in the public square, literally on the Maidan. The role of the Ukrainian churches, therefore, in the protests was not marginal but central. And this role has reflected the still highly religious character of the Ukrainian society and of the Ukrainian people, which has high expectations from the churches as well, and who are extremely attentive to the voices of the churches. The Ukrainian churches in the beginning of the protests were not up to the expectations of the awakening civil society, and this applies to all the churches, to the Patriarchate of Kyiv, to the Moscow Patriarchate, to the Greek Catholic Church. They were actually unprepared for such events. And they had to grow up together with Maidan to meet the expectations of the people on the Maidan. And during the Maidan, the churches adopted either they wanted it or didn't want it, a new model of relations with the society. The traditional model of relations with the society for the Ukrainian churches was quite a kind of Byzantine, which presupposed that the church had to maintain good relations with the state and often disregarded the society as a separate, as an independent constituency. The Maidan showed that there can be a very harsh opposition between the state and the society. The society can go against the state, and the state can go against the society. It was very clear on the Maidan. And the church actually faced a very difficult dilemma of choosing between two of them. Traditionally, the churches aligned with the state, and now they were challenged with a difficult choice to align either with the state or with the society. The problem was for the church, for the churches, was that they couldn't align with both, because the church and the society was at war, the society and the state, sorry, was at war with each other. So the churches had to choose, they could not avoid choosing. And to the credit of all the churches, I should say that all of them, to a lesser or a greater extent, eventually chose the society as their partner, not the state. The most active in supporting the social awakening was the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. The Patriarchate of Kyiv was more reluctant in aligning with the protesters at the beginning, but eventually firmly supported them. It offered, for instance, the protesters at St. Michael's Monastery in the center of Kyiv, which was turned to a hospital and a shelter for the protesters who sought protection from the riot police. The Ukrainian Church of the Moscow Patriarchate tried to keep neutrality. There were hierarchs and priests who openly supported the regime of Yanukovych. There were also priests of this church who made a stand in favor of the Maidan. I knew personally some priests who, for instance, incognito went to the Maidan and helped building barricades. You know, they didn't want to be noticed in order to avoid possible sanctions, but nevertheless they tried to contribute to the Maidan. But eventually the Ukrainian Church of the Moscow Patriarchate condemned the regime, though it happened almost simultaneously with the fall of the regime. I find an interesting parallel of the churches, Ukrainian churches in Ukraine, with the Greek churches in Greece, exactly 40 years ago. The circumstances of the regime of Yanukovych, is similar to the regime of the Greek junta that ruled from 1967 to 1974. And the circumstances of the churches in Ukraine were similar to the circumstances of the Greek church in Greece 40 years ago. Although the motifs of the regimes of Yanukovych and of the Greek colonels of the junta were different, the methods of establishing dictatorship were similar. Both usurped power, changed the constitution, subdued courts, relied on the law enforcement agencies to suppress dissidents, and established authoritarianism. A particularly striking similarity is that the junta ended after the student insurgents of the in the Polytechnic University of Athens in November 1973, and the Maidan came to its active phase after the students of Kyiv were beaten on the night of the 30th of November 2013, exactly 40 years later. The other similarity between, another similarity is the attitude of the regime to the church. In both cases, the regime was supposed to favor somehow the agenda of the church. The regime of the Greek junta was kind of favoring the conservative values, like they closed down all the nightclubs and they introduced some strict behavior rules in the public. And at the same time, they violated very much the internal constituency of the church. They removed the old primate of the church, they replaced him with their own protege, they also removed, they reconfigured the synod of the church and so forth. The same happened with Yanukovych, who, despite all his, you know, apparent favor to the Orthodox Church, in particular to the Church of the Moscow Patriarchate, committed unbelievable things against that church. I could tell you more about this, but wouldn't now stick to that. Even more, he was hostile he was to other Ukrainian churches. So essentially, Yanukovych was, although he declared himself to be Orthodox, he insulted every church in Ukraine. This was probably one of the reasons why the churches eventually turned against him. And but not the only reason, because the churches started realizing the potential to the power of the transformations that happened on the Maidan. During the 3 months of the protests, the Ukrainian churches matured in their stand vis-à-vis the social and moral issues that the Maidan attempted to resolve. They appreciated the non-violent character of the protests, and they enhanced this character of the Maidan. They gradually supported the moral agenda of the protesters and gave them theological legitimacy. They also re-evaluated their relationship with the state. In the triangle church-state-society, they chose to align with the latter, with the society. Although this reorientation has happened in the history of the Eastern churches many times, it is not common for them. The realignment of the Ukrainian churches with the society at the expense of the relationship with the political regime enhanced an alternative pattern of the relations of the Eastern Christian churches with the state. And that is an important thing about the Maidan for the entire, you know, Orthodox world, because the Maidan has demonstrated that an alternative way of relationship with the state is possible not only for the Catholic Church, but also for the Orthodox Church. The Orthodox Church is not, by definition, a state church. It's not, by definition, something that always supports the state. The church can also support the society. And this is a kind of shift, radical shift in the paradigm, traditional Orthodox paradigm of the relations with the state. And the contribution of the Maidan in this shift is significant, is historical, really historical. And another shift in the traditional paradigms of relations of the church with the state and the church with the people is that the alignment of the church with the people can take the forms other than nationalism. You know, we always speak among the Orthodox about our common kind of phenomena, that the Orthodox churches, after the starting with the in the beginning of the 19th century, became associated with the national states, and the churches became a kind of national churches, which is a common model of, you know, of working together with people. The churches aligned, well, we should be somehow fair by saying that, well, the churches did not work only with the state. The churches also worked with the people, but the churches took the form of national bodies. It happened, it happened in the 19th century in the Balkan countries, when the sovereignty of the state moved from the sovereign, from the monarch, to the people. This happened in the 19th century in terms of the political developments. And the church felt this shift of gravitation, of the political gravitation, which moved from the person of the kind of monarch, right, to the representative bodies like parliament and so forth. And the church also moved together with this center of gravity and became aligned with the bearer of the authority, which became the nation, ethnos. And this contributed to change that occurred to the church, which became a kind of national body. Okay? And since then, the Orthodox churches have become a kind of national churches. But what the Maidan has shown that this alignment of the churches with the national bodies can go beyond the national boundaries. The churches can support not only the national agenda of the people, but also the civil agenda of the people. The church can associate themselves not only with the national identity of the people, but the church can also associate itself with the civil identity, civil demands of the people. For instance, if the main concern of the people is social justice, not just national identity, but social justice, absence of corruption, you know, a new kind of community building, the church can go with that. The church can support that. Because, again, Maidan was not just a struggle for the national identity of the Ukrainian people. It was a struggle for a new social agenda for the Ukrainian people. People came to Maidan speaking either Russian or Ukrainian, and they had the same cause. They wanted to overthrow the regime, and they wanted the justice, fairness, transparency, absence of corruption to be re-established. They wanted to protect their dignity. They wanted to protect their humanity. All these are the features of the social agenda, civil agenda, and the church supported them. The church thus went a step further than just national agenda. Now this is an important shift that the Maidan has demonstrated, and which a shift which became a kind of new thing in the Orthodox world. In this regard, Maidan was also a unique phenomenon. The Maidan also created a new national narrative. So the Maidan did not stand somehow aside of the aspirations of the Ukrainian people as Ukrainian people. You know that before recently, the Ukrainian identity was built on the events of the Kozaki, 16th, 17th century events in Ukraine, Bohdan Khmelnytsky, liberation movements of Ukraine and so forth, especially as those events were kind of romanticized in the 19th century. It was an important narrative, nation-building narrative. It actually kept Ukrainian people together for a long time, and hopefully will continue keeping people together, will continue forming their identity. But what I think Maidan has added to this is that people can be united around the values such as dignity, such as humanity, such as freedom, responsible freedom, such as solidarity, such as readiness to sacrifice everything they have, altruism, and so forth. Everything that Maidan showed, demonstrated. And Maidan thus has created a new, I believe, a new national narrative which will be told and retold many times in the future, on which the new generations of the Ukrainians will be nourished and will grow. This narrative is not contradictory to the old narratives of the Ukrainian people, no. But it is a valuable and important addition, helps the Ukrainian people to identify themselves. Because, well, continuing the famous book of Kuchma, Ukraina не Росія, Ukraine is not Russia. Well, Maidan has clearly demonstrated why it is not Russia, because it can struggle for the human, you know, dignity and things like that. And this civil agenda, human agenda, agenda of dignity, became an important part of the Maidan's agenda, and has become an important part of the Ukrainian identity nowadays. And what is important for us, that the church has become an important part of this narrative as well. You cannot now speak about Maidan, and therefore you will be unable to define what Ukrainian people are if you ignore the churches, the participation of the church in the events of the Maidan. Thus, the churches and the people who came to the Maidan and the people who died on the Maidan became kind of fused into a single narrative, which will be defining for the Ukrainian people, hopefully for centuries, for their generations. Well, that's the conclusion I'd like to come to. And now I want to share with you some images which will hopefully demonstrate what I've just said, and which are quite iconic in a sense that they really symbolize what happened on the Maidan and how it developed. Well, that's how it started. It started with the students being beaten on the Maidan on the 30th of November, and this image became a famous kind of representation of the anger of the Ukrainian people who came to the Maidan after the students were beaten. This is how Maidan came together, how crowded it was. And this is the moment when Maidan could easily overthrow the regime if he applied some, it applied some, well, some force. So. And these are the, as I said, the terms, the words, the phrases, the narratives related to religion, in which the terms in which Maidan started expressing itself very early. This is the way how people prayed on the Maidan. This is really extraordinary. Or this one, crowds, you know, kneeling on the square in prayer. And I think it is, if we want to speak about the church in the public square nowadays, this is probably one of the best images to describe the presence of the church in the public square. This is a prayer tent which was set up on the Maidan soon after it started. You see, it says it's a prayer tent, Molitor Minamet. Well, this is the way that the priests were present on the Maidan. This is to demonstrate the peaceful character of the Maidan, actually. It was really kind of, with a great contribution of the students. Initially, it was a student, actually, revolution. And later on, it turned to be a different kind of revolution. It's interesting at the background, you see. Here, it's Name Bog, the inscription. This is the way. The famous picture. This one, another one. So this is to demonstrate that the essence of the Maidan was really a peaceful protest. Where he tried, you know, to convince the backward people not to apply any violence. They prayed them. But it didn't work. And the interesting thing is that you see this lady. She tries to protect this protester who was taken by the police with cross, another religious symbol. You know probably the story of this picture. This is a professor of Polytechnic University in Kyiv with his son. By the propaganda, these kind of people were presented as terrorists and extremists, but this is actually the a kind of people who were present in their majority on the Maidan, and they were beaten and treated in this way. Or another kind of extremist, a correspondent of Reuters. Extremist from the point of view of the propaganda, of the Russian propaganda. And after all this happened, after people were treated in this way, of course they had no other choice but to protest and to react sometimes violently. And the church tried to be in the middle between the fighting groups. And there were remarkable samples of the church's mediation, church's taking the part of peacemaker. This is another perspective of the same picture. Now you see people, well, the priests just confessed people, they just contributed in any possible way to make the Maidan really peaceful, to keep the Maidan really peaceful. And it applied not only to the Orthodox churches, but this is, you see, this is a nice picture of a Lutheran pastor who tried also to mediate, to protect. And interestingly enough, Maidan has become a kind of ecumenical phenomenon when the priests somehow disregarded their jurisdictional and canonical controversies and just try to help people. And I believe Maidan thus has demonstrated a model for the Ukrainian churches to reconcile. So far we tried, you know, to have some kind of dialogue with each other. But it didn't work, and it doesn't work, unfortunately. And probably the model that the Maidan has indicated may work. When we have a common goal to achieve, when we have a common destination to reach, and then when we try to come to the same destination, we'll get closer and closer to each other and may overcome one day the schisms and the divisions within the Ukrainian churches that exist. And I think this methodology of approaching each other can be much more effective than the dialogues that we try to have and which doesn't work, which don't work, unfortunately. Another way of, another picture of how the priests acted on the Maidan. This actually expresses the kind of self-identification of the Maidan. The people on the Maidan believe that they are kind of Vox Dei, being Vox Populi. Well, it didn't work well. I mean, the mediation of the church and the attempts to keep the peaceful character of the Maidan, and it bursted into the outbreaks of violence. And then the now we will see the scenes of violence which dominated somehow the media coverage of the Maidan. Still, the priests were still, even when the Maidan turned to be violent, the priests continued to be present there. Now they had to protect themselves with their helmets, and the respirators, but still didn't leave the scene. This is the St. Michael's Monastery, which was turned into a hospital and a shelter. You see the on the backstage there is a priest reading something like, I don't know, Psalms, and people just having rest in the church. And they turned also one of the churches into a hospital. Well, for some, Maidan ended very badly, and this is a man who was obviously shot by a sniper. And the church had to be, well, the church had to be present there. These are those who were fallen. And so the church was present there as well, even at the most dramatic moments of their developments. These are the flowers which people brought to the in memory of the Heavenly Hundred. Now this picture, I like it because it shows exactly the character, everything that Maidan was all about. It was all about being human, you know. Even in the midst of the fierce violence, people remained human because that was the main cause of the Maidan. And it is a cause noble enough to be definitely supported by the Church and to be enhanced by the Church. Well, that's a story in pictures about the Maidan, and I think it will continue. It will have more pictures, but I think the Church being present at all the stages of the Maidan, being a part of the Maidan at even in the hardest moments of the protests, I think will be forever remembered and will define how the Church will relate to the society, to the Ukrainian society in the future. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We invite you to think together with Father Kirill to raise issues, speak to what you've heard, and engage in a bit of conversation. Please.
It was refreshing to hear how the churches stood with the people at the Maidan. You referred, though, to the churches, pointing out that the priests of various divisions stood with the people. But what about the hierarchs, the position of the hierarchs of all the churches? And I'm especially interested in perhaps the Moscow Patriarch, to which I suppose you owe some allegiance. Isn't he the most powerful church person? And what with his attitude? I think that he is sort of a strong Putinist, neo-Soviet model, power-hungry person that would have said a great deal. When you talk about the churches on the Maidan, what about the hierarchs, especially the ones to whom you owe allegiance?
Yeah. Well, it's an important and a frequently asked question for good reasons, of course. As I mentioned, the churches participated in the events of the Maidan to different degrees, and the degree to which the Ukrainian Church of the Moscow Patriarchate participated in the events was not particularly remarkable, I would say, for a number of reasons. First, yes, the Ukrainian Church of the Moscow, under the Moscow Patriarchate, is it's a very complex thing. You can find everything there. Starting from the Ukrainian nationalism up to the complete negation, rejection of Ukraine as a separate people, as a distant people. I think the Ukrainian Church of the Moscow Patriarchate is a kind of reflection, mirror of what the Ukrainian society is. In this regard, it is different, it is distant from the rest of the Ukrainian churches, which reflect some particular parts of the Ukrainian society. Say the Patriarchate of Kyiv, the majority of its flock and its stand in the Ukrainian society and in the Ukrainian state reflect the Ukrainian patriots, obviously. The same applies to the Greek Catholic Church. But I think the Ukrainian Church of the Moscow Patriarchate reflects the whole spectrum of the Ukrainian society and all the Ukrainian regions. And as it is a kind of double-edged thing, because on the one hand, it somehow ties the hands of the Church in expressing its public position. On the other hand, it provides the Ukrainian society with a unique instrument of outreaching every stratum, every part, piece of the Ukrainian people, of the Ukrainian society. Because if you consider the inhabitants of Crimea, Crimea still belongs to Ukraine, and the Crimean people still the people of Ukraine. If you consider the people in Donbas, in Kharkiv, in Luhansk, as Ukrainians, they are Ukrainians. And the church, Ukrainian church, under the Moscow Patriarchate, is probably one of the few Ukrainian institutions nowadays that can reach, outreach those people. Imagine that in Crimea we have the church as probably the only Ukrainian institution surviving there, existing there as a Ukrainian institution. And this dictates the church to be cautious in expressing its positions, to be sometimes silent. I was myself very often critical about the silence of my church on the events in Ukraine. I thought that that position was somehow hesitant, not it was cowardish somehow. On the other hand, I can understand why the church adopted this kind of silence in order not to fall apart, to get split, because exactly this would facilitate the split of the Ukrainian society. I was actively engaged in the visit of the Patriarch Bartholomew in 2008 to Ukraine. Then the plan of President Yushchenko was to to create a structure of the Ecumenical Patriarchate in Ukraine and to allow in Ukraine to exist the two jurisdictions would exist in Ukraine, one under the Ecumenical Patriarchate and the other under the Moscow Patriarchate. I should confess that I opposed this kind of plans, because I believed that creation of two jurisdictions in Ukraine would create a way to the split of the country into two parts. The country would fall apart, would be separated to two parts along the lines of the separation between the churches. At that time I believed, and my colleagues believed, that the only way to preserve the integrity of the country and to heal the schisms, the divisions within the church, was to create a one local Ukrainian church without allowing two canonical jurisdictions in the same country, exactly for the purpose to preserve the integrity of the country. And you know, I did a lot in order to deliver this message to the leadership of Ukraine at the time. I explained that, you know, if you allow this kind of division between the two canonical jurisdictions of Ukraine, you will lose the country. And you know what I was told back? That why don't you think that it has been meant like this? You know, by people who designed this kind of creation of two jurisdictions. Therefore, I believe it is crucially important for the Church to remain one and to reach all parts of the country if we want to preserve the country as a unitarian one single Ukrainian state. Therefore, I can understand the Church that kept sometimes silence in order to preserve its own integrity and thus to preserve the integrity of the society and of the country. Again, I repeat that I was very critical about the silence. But now I understand, given the events in the eastern parts of Ukraine, as we see them now, that there was some sense in, you know, in keeping some silence in order to get more, in order to preserve, to save the country and its integrity. You can criticize this. But you see where we go. I don't know if you are satisfied with this kind of with this answer. But well, and again, what is important there is that the churches united their voices in condemning, you know, the violence, condemning the aggression from Russia against Crimea. Through the Всеукраїнська Рада Церков Релігійних Організацій, the All-Ukrainian Council of the Churches and Religious Organizations, which is a very effective instrument of the inter-church, inter-religious cooperation, which also embraces Jewish and Muslim communities in Ukraine. Now this is probably one of the most effective ecumenical instruments in Ukraine. It is a self-organized community of the representatives of the churches, and well, it happened by coincidence that during the period of the Maidan and the following aggression against Ukraine, the Ukrainian Church of the Moscow Patriarchate presided in that organization, in that council, and they produced promptly different kinds of declarations that condemned the violence of the regime of Yanukovych. They condemned the aggression, and I know that for many of these documents, declarations, the drafters were the representatives of the Ukrainian Church of the Moscow Patriarchate. So this was an instrument, an effective instrument of, you know, of voicing out the concerns of the religious communities, including the Jewish and Muslim communities. I would like to stress. And given their special concerns, especially in the Western media, enhanced by the Russian propaganda, that Maidan was probably kind of anti-Semitic or, you know, anti-Jewish, which was a plain propaganda, that voice of the religious organizations and of the churches, one common voice, was extremely important. And no one was excluded or retrieved itself from this kind of voicing out the concerns.
You mentioned today, if I recall correctly, at the university, just a little bit about, I'm not quite sure what the appropriate word is to choose here, but the reticence of the autonomous or the autocephalous church in Ukraine, that it really did not, or was very modest in its participation in Maidan. Could you, that might give this a little more texture. Could you speak about how that worked a little bit?
Yes, unfortunately, the Ukrainian autocephalous Orthodox Church, which is a kind of offspring of the church in Canada, was not notoriously heard in Ukraine. I think it kept even more silence than the Moscow Patriarchate in Ukraine. The churches that were most somehow active in producing declarations were the Greek Catholic Church and the Patriarchate of Kiev, but not the Autocephalous Church. And this is really a puzzle. This is really kind of, I don't understand why this happened. Well, probably it happened because this church, unfortunately, has lost the charm that it had in early 90s, when it somehow embodied, you know, the aspirations of people for the renewal of the society. Interestingly, that the church at the time, the Autocephalous Church, was really a kind of a machine of the social transformations, or at least there were expectations in the society that this church would become this kind of engine of the social transformations, of the desovietization of the Ukrainian society. That's why the church attracted many people from intelligentsia, intellectuals, so forth. But all of a sudden it changed its profile. It has lost its this kind of charm, this kind of steam of the, you know, social power. And this became particularly apparent in the events of the Maidan, when the church remained almost silent.
One thing you said that I found troubling, and that was when you used the word align.
Yeah.
With the church aligning itself either with the state or with the society. Let me expose my prejudice. I think the Byzantine Symphony is at best a terrible idea and at worst heretical. Okay. I don't think that the church and the state have any business being in business together. But I think that the church's role is to be prophetic to both sides, to speak to both sides and say, thus says the Lord, not to align with either side, but to align with the gospel of Christ and with holy tradition, and to say to both sides, to say, I mean, my heavenly patron is Metropolitan Philip of Moscow,
yeah,
who was strangled by Ivan Grozny,
yeah,
okay, for opening his mouth at the wrong time. So maybe there's something genetic.
If you buy the poisoned body, you die.
Yeah. If the whole notion of the church aligning itself with either side, and admittedly this is from a North American perspective, is a mistake. Yeah, the church has to embrace, has to lead the aspirations of the society, and shape them according to the values of Christ.
Yeah.
So alignment makes me nervous.
Well, it's an excellent question, and I think I tried to answer to it early at the university when I was asked, what about the Russian church in Russia? The presumption was that the Russian church in Russia goes with the state instead of going with the society, which is wrong, because the church in Russia goes with the society, with the majority of people who 80% support the war against Ukraine, 80% of people support Putin, and all these kind of things. So this is an example of a church aligning with the society on the ground of wrong values. And this is the case when the church should say something which stems from the gospel in order to raise its prophetic voice, in order to say what is wrong and what is right. In case of the Maidan, though Maidan, it would be naive and would be not really Christian to consider Maidan as a kind of revelation. No. It was just an important social phenomenon, but what Maidan indicated was that Actually, the ethical agenda of the Maidan was supposed to be upheld by the churches, to be promoted by the churches, but it was not, in fact. Because the Maidan raised its voice against the corruption. Which one of the churches raised its voice against the corruption under Yanukovych? No one. While the churches were supposed to raise their voice, and they didn't. In this sense, Maidan has taught the churches the job that the churches had to do. And I think the churches eventually aligned with the Maidan because they recognized that, well, ethically speaking, the ethical agenda of the Maidan was really something that they were themselves to support and to promote in the society, and they were not good enough, you know, to embody this kind of awareness about the level of the corruption, injustice that became dominant in the era of Yanukovych. Of course, if we imagine one day that the that Maidan would become something different, would turn to a violent, you know, kind of abusive phenomenon, the church had to say it plainly. Yes, it is wrong, because it is against the gospel. No one says it is good. Therefore, the churches should not go blind following, you know, the agenda of the social developments. No. The churches should lead at the best, or warn, or say what is wrong and what is correct. But first of all, that they need to apply this to themselves, because otherwise they will act like Pharisees.
Please.
You're referring to the Ukrainian church under the Russian Moscow Patriarch. When did this name change occur? When it's the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine?
No. The formal. The name of the church, as it has been registered with the Ukrainian state since early 1990s, is the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, full stop. That is the official name of the church.
And all the services are conducted in Ukrainian?
No, in Slavonic. But in many cases, especially in the western parts of Ukraine, they are conducted in Ukrainian. And it has been left by the synod to the choice of the community. So if the community chooses to conduct a service in Ukrainian, it is free to do so. Or if the church, if a community chooses to conduct the service in Romanian, as it is often the case in Bukovina, it is free to conduct. So it has been left to decide by the community, not by the central authority of the church.
So this was, if you're saying, when Ukraine got its independence, the church was registered as a Ukrainian
Orthodox Church. Yeah, that is the juridical name of the. Yeah, yeah. Even without the, you know, addition of the Moscow Patriarchate, it was dropped. That is the legal name of the church.
Yes, in fact, the Ukrainian church is independent from Moscow.
Well, to some extent.
To
quite.
To a big extent.
Yeah. Well, formally. Formally speaking, the Ukrainian church is, well, there is a stereotype that the Ukrainian church sends some money to Moscow. This is a completely wrong understanding. No, no money to Moscow from Ukraine. I can assure you, well, if you believe me. Second, the canonical status of the Ukrainian church is quite strange, because it is not an autonomous church. But it is the church with the rights of autonomy, which means that it elects its own bishops, it has its own synod, it elects its own primate, which has to be, though, confirmed by the Patriarch of Moscow. That is the only sort of canonical relationship to Moscow for this church. The problem with this status of the Ukrainian Church is that recently we have realized that the rules can change dramatically, unexpectedly. This is the time when the rules are not observed. You see, Russia intrudes to Ukraine, violating all kinds of international law and rules, and, well, who cares? The same may happen to the Church one day, and this is really worrying. But speaking formally, speaking in terms of the documents, well, the Church is really independent, de facto, effectively. Say, of course, there is a good deal of influence, because there is a number of hierarchs within the Ukrainian Church who are wholeheartedly supporting the Russian cause, the Russian world, and so forth. Well, that is a reality that we have. And again, we have a reality of the parliament members. I completely disagree with this kind of position, but we should, I think, look at this picture wider. We have members of the Ukrainian parliament, we have governors of the Ukrainian provinces that collaborate with Russia. We had the Minister of Defense, we had the President of the SBU, the Security Service of Ukraine, who were openly the agent of the FSB, the Russian Secret Service. And they were in the leadership of the country. And they actually, that regime was voted for by the people of Ukraine. We want, either we want it or we don't want it. Well, that is the reality of Ukraine. It is a deeply vulnerable country, vulnerable society, which needs to be stabilized, and which needs to be, you know, reconciled nowadays. And how to do this, I don't know really. We have a situation of when the gene was released from the bottle, we cannot just put it back to the bottle. We have a situation of the of creation of a new separatist mythology, of opposition, of neglecting, of rejection of Ukraine as a state, as a nation, in the eastern parts of Ukraine, and people die for that kind of, you know, idea. And how to reconcile those people with the rest of the country is ultimately problematic. It's a very difficult task. You cannot just, you know, switch the situation back, go back to the normal business. It will never happen. Now we face a situation when for years, if not decades, we will have to step by step, very slowly, reconcile the country. Unfortunately, but there is no way.
And you really see in some possibility of a new narrative, which will play a role in that reconciliation.
Yeah. Yes, definitely so. But the problem is that many in Ukraine reject Maidan as a narrative.
Yeah.
And they've created a kind of anti-Maidan narrative. And you cannot just build... I was very hopeful that the narrative of the Maidan can be a kind of umbrella for the entire country. It seems now that it's not going to happen. We need to create, to reconcile, to bridge at least the two narratives that they've been created. And what kind of super narrative will we have in Ukraine is problematic. It's still unclear. But we need to face this as a reality. We should be really realistic if we want really to preserve the country.
There are several people that wish to speak, but I can't keep track of you.
Please. We trust in the Moscow paper.
Yeah.
Or his involvement in Russia, or can't the Moscow Patriarch Church in Ukraine divorce itself enough to thrill the Moscow paper?
Yeah, as I said, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church under the Moscow Patriarchate reflects the situation in the country. Well, can we trust the people in the eastern parts of Ukraine? Well, that's the question. Can we trust those who will win in the eastern part of Ukraine? And they will just go with them, either with the, you know, Donetsk Respublika or with Kyiv. I think the church is very diverse. This church is very diverse. And we did everything to prevent this kind of, you know, this kind of separatism. What I mean, in 2007, the church condemned the so-called political orthodoxy, Politichna Pravoslavia, at the council of the church, which was convened in December of 2007. And the purpose of that condemnation was exactly to disable the ideological power of the pro-Russian trend within the Ukrainian church. Implicitly, this condemnation of the political orthodoxy was addressing the, you know, the fundamentalists who went with, actually, personally, the only person who was condemned at that time was Valery Kaurov, who was recently proclaimed a kind of president of the Odessa Respublika. So this was, he's the kind of guy who was meant by that condemnation. The people who used the church in order to pursue their own political agendas, which were the agenda of Russia. And it is quite symptomatically that the person who was condemned in 2007 as a kind of chief of the political orthodox, Kaurov, now became the self-proclaimed of president of the Donetsk Respublika. So the church tried really hard to protect itself and the society from this kind of abuses of the church by the pro-Russian ideologically charged people. I don't want to be a kind of apologist of the Ukrainian Church of the Moscow Patriarchate. I think criticized too much what it did during the events of the Maidan. But I think we need to be fair in our criticism. We should be critical, but we need to be fair and to understand that the church is not really it's not really a single structure. It is really a kind of network, and within this network, this church allowed a good deal of, you know, freedom on the sides, different sides, like eastern part of southern part of Ukraine, and this allowed the church to exist somehow, more or less as a single body. And not only just to exist, but also to preserve some integrity of the country. And the church, this church, tried hard to eliminate all kinds of political abuses on the Russian behalf within the church. And it certainly condemned the attempts to, you know, of this, of separatism. If you remember, there was a Kievan priest, Andriy Tkachuk, who publicly from the Ambo condemned and cursed those who went to the Maidan. And he was summoned to the Metropolia, and he was very strongly warned that he should not, you know, make this kind of declarations from the church Ambo. He was silenced, actually. And this was, I think, an important step. Now, what shall we do with those priests who really support the separatists and who really come along with them? Should they be defrocked or, I don't know, or suspended or whatever? Well, under the conditions of peaceful time, probably they should. But if you imagine that the church now somehow, well, defrocks such a priest, for instance, you will create in this way a condition, a premise for that part of the church splitting and deepening the divide within the society, and making Ukraine, you know, just splitting it into pieces.
Thank you, Father, for your presentation. And there were a few terms that I think were very interesting, and I'm wondering from your perspective, now in the United States, right now, you're visiting us in Canada, to speak about this Maidan as a sort of post-secular reality.
Yeah.
And I remember in 1968, the year that the Greek Revolution spoke of, the Protestant theologian Karl Barth visited the United States, the epitome of the separation of church and state, and his comment was the words of the Apostle Paul, "I can see in every way you are very religious."
Yeah.
So what does the experience of the Maidan and the experience of the past development in this creation of this post-secular society have to say to the secular societies or our reality in liberal democracies in the West? What does it have to say in this direction about the experience of the church in public life, maybe in our context?
Yes, I think the Maidan destroys a myth, a powerful myth of the secular era of the era of secularization. Well, whatever, if another question is whether there was such an era, because it is still, it is kind of argued by the scholars where there was at all an era of secularization. Thank you so much, Father. You've noticed that my voice has changed. And the popular myth of the secularists was that actually the society should develop on its own, just because the church not only doesn't help the society to develop as democracy, but the church also prevents the society from developing. It functions like a brake for the society. And this was an excuse for the liberal society to get rid of the church, to get rid, to neglect the religious aspect. And I think what the Maidan in Kiev has shown is exactly the opposite, that the society not only develops without obstacles from the church, but it is facilitated by the church in its development. Now it is impossible to imagine Maidan as a secular phenomenon, developing, you know, regardless of what the church was and said. But the Maidan can be imagined only with those pictures, you know, with the active presence of the church on the every stage of the development of the Maidan, in its heights and its lows. And that is, I think, an important message to the Western social thinkers and political thinkers, that the development of the civil society is good, and it can occur, and in some contexts it can only occur with the active participation of the church. And it does not mean that the church should be, you know, kind of servant, something inferior to the civil society. No, it should voice out its concerns when the development of the society doesn't go right. But the church, by definition, is not opposite to any kind of social development, to the transformation of the society to a civil society.
The church isn't an ideological fraternity.
Exactly.
On either side. It's different from that.
Yeah.
It's Lebanon.
Yeah.
It's Lebanon and Credit.
Yeah, you just put into words what I was struggling to articulate, and then
develop a little bit, and that is to say that the church has been present in Western society, actively engaged in its own development. And I think of the Berrigan brothers and their struggle against the war in Vietnam, the drought in Vietnam. I think of the priests in the barrios of Latin America. I think of Mother Teresa in Desmond Tutu in South Africa. I'm thinking of two figures in particular, and I'm wondering, in reference to what we saw in Maidan, Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
What we see in these images is that witness, the witness to the gospel in society. But it seemed to me with Gandhi and Martin Luther King, it was one step further. There was a kind of praxis that emerged that was consistent with that witness to the gospel, and was called civil disobedience. And so it was more than just standing in the middle of chaos at the cross or hearing confession. It was here is actually how we can act in Christ. Right? Can you see anything like that? I'm very discouraged by your competing narratives now, but perhaps there's a kind of ecumenical Maidan narrative that can
I think the next step would be the step towards reconciliation of the country. And I think the role of the church will be indispensable in this step, in making this step. And I just want to recall the famous book of Desmond Tutu, where he dealt with the problems of apartheid and overcoming apartheid, which is called like something like between the tribunal and the historic anamnesis. There are two ways of dealing with the divides within the society, as it was the case in South Africa after apartheid. There was a way of, you know, just forgetting everything, all the traumas that happened to the divided society of South Africa, the historical amnesia. And there was a way of, you know, remembering everything and paying back for everything, the tribunal. And the point of Desmond Tutu was exactly that the society, the divided society, should avoid both extremes. And this can be done only through the Christian message. Particularly, Desmond Tutu employed the idea of Ubuntu. It's a kind of South African traditional concept which is built on the idea of the dignity of human personality, on the one hand, and on the other hand, also deals with the idea of reconciliation. I believe that only the churches can do this. And I think this is the unique role of the churches at the next stage in Ukraine. They should pursue the role of reconciliation. But the nuance about this of this reconciliation is that it should not mean stepping back to the old paradigms of the social development, to the corruption. You know, let us just we see how what kind of reaction caused Maidan, the counter-revolution in the East, the protests, violent, bloody protests in the East, in Odessa, where 40 people died, were burned. Let us just go back, you know, to the times before Maidan. Let us forget this. This would be a wrong step, definitely. And the role of the church is, on the one hand, to encourage the further transformation of the society in the direction which was dictated by the Maidan, and at the same time to do a reconciliation work for the society, a very difficult task. But I think only the church can do this kind of task, and could lead the society to achieve this kind of goal.
Yeah.
Well, I would say that the churches were not leading the social progress in Ukraine. Yes, we should admit this. Say it plainly.
Like the truth and reconciliation idea, I can see that. When people actually speak their truth.
Yeah.
And people in Eastern Ukraine can speak to their hurt.
Yeah.
Their fear, you know. It's not about sort of getting over it. Or taking lessons from my God. But they have to be heard. in order for the vision
that's exactly my point. That's exactly my point, that those people, even if we don't agree with them, I don't agree with them, but I believe they should be heard, and their voices should be taken into consideration by everyone in Ukraine, as the voice of Maidan was to be taken into consideration. And actually, that was another point of my presentation, is that the churches were behind the developments initiated by the Maidan, and they had to catch up with them. Well, that is the reality. We should not be kind of optimistic about the role of the church. They were behind. And the thing is, if they will continue supporting the positive changes in the society, it is still questionable. No, we don't expect the churches, well, to have our own Martin Luther King. Well, it's our reality. The question is that the church, under the Soviet regime, did not really realize the potentiality, its own potentiality to change the society. It was confined to, you know, to the liturgical rites, to the liturgical practices, confined, you know, to pastoral care, which is fine, but not more than that. And even in the post-Soviet situation, we have the same paradigm continuing. When the church considers itself only in terms of, you know, offering confession and Eucharist, which is great, great, but which does not reach very far beyond the walls of the temple, of the churches. And now, well, when the church people came to the Maidan, stepped out of the churches, this creates a new situation, a new understanding for the church. The church considers itself now as a part of the public square, as a participant in the public process. This is a completely new thing, and the church came to realize this only recently on the Maidan. And again, how it will continue behaving on the public square, it is still questionable. There is no a guarantee that the church will continue like that. Maybe at one moment it may be just scared of this new reality and just retreat back to its shell.
Or maybe not.
Or maybe not. There is a chance, and this chance gives a hope, that maybe the church will stay there.
So, for the Kirill, thank you very much for the report. So, but I don't agree with some points. I want you to disappoint me. At first, in Maidan, this prosecution way and sports way at the same time, is a global project. It's a global event, not national event of Ukraine, not two-side event of Russia and Ukraine, but event of United States, of Europe, and most important of China. So this is a global event. So we must to see two colors, black and white. So this is a global event. We have to speak from global point of view. Second, it is always, we say, pro-Russian. Pro-Russian is not, to my opinion, very bad word, because Putin, bureaucracy and Russian people are different entities, different things. Even today we know that leader of trade union of miners in Donetsk, exposed the point of view of Donetsk region. He said, we are Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. We don't want miners of Donetsk don't want to join Russia. Mm-hmm. They are not pro-Russian. Mm-hmm. They are Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. They don't want to join Russia. So this difference between Putin bureaucracy and Russian mm-hmm. people, it is different entities. And the second is the regime of Yanukovych. From the third glance, from the, how to say, If I am not acquainted with the recent history of newest history of this region, I can say that Yanukovych came to power a few years ago after Soviet after socialist country. But already Ukraine absolutely independent country for 25 years.
Yeah.
Absolutely different country. And you must know that when Yanukovych came to power, became a president, the number of billion guys in Ukraine doubled.
Yeah.
From 2010, according to Forbes journal,
always reliable.
Huh?
Always
reliable. Yes. Billion guys doubled in Ukraine.
Yeah.
So it is not the regime of Yanukovych, it is the regime of Ukraine elite, which was born from the moment of independence.
Mm-hmm.
And it is regime of greed of Ukrainian elite. So it is, responsibility of, of Ukrainian nation, not of one person.
Yeah.
And to my opinion, it is going to be like Polish shakhtar.
Yeah.
Ukrainian elite go after, not after monarchy of Russia or something else, they are going after Polish shlachta,
yeah.
Polish, this elite of Polish people in recent centuries. So, if I am not right, I want to be disappointed by
Thank you.
Three questions.
Thank you very much.
Well, I will disappoint you. I would agree with what you said. Because, well, that's true, but it is largely about the system that Yanukovych not created but enhanced. It's a system of the oligarchic state. And actually, the oligarchs bring him to the power in order to, you know, to manipulate him and to use him, to make him instrumental for their own purposes. The problem for them was that Yanukovych turned himself into an oligarch and tried to, a big shark that tried to eat them up. And again, I would emphasize the importance of what you said about the Ukrainian miners of Donbass who said that we are Ukrainians. And we witness here a situation of many Ukrainians within the same Ukraine. We witness here a situation of multiple Ukrainian identities. What is important about those identities is that all of them, they are Ukrainian. But they have also some differences. They would disagree on certain points. But in this situation, it doesn't matter. And I think what is the value of Ukraine? What is the unique... Well, it's kind of abusive language to speak about unique role of any state. But I think it is important about Ukraine to remember that it is an inclusive country. An inclusive culture, a culture that embraces varieties of things, which has demonstrated throughout the centuries an extraordinary openness, at least in comparison with its northern neighbor. If we speak about new narrative of the Ukraine, it is a narrative of an open society, of an open and tolerant and inclusive country, which makes it really special, at least in the post-Soviet context, because it is not usual that a post-Soviet country demonstrates this kind of openness and inclusiveness. And it comes natural somehow from the soul of the people. And I think when people feel, different people with different, you know, confessions of their identities feel comfortable within the same framework, Ukrainian framework, I think this is great. And this is the way to preserve the integrity of the country, the integrity of the people, and simultaneously by allowing the people to be who they are. To recognize what they are, not to extrapolate our own idea about what Ukrainian, what the Ukrainian people are, and to impose on them our own ideas about what they should be. They are what they are. They are miners. They drink vodka, you know. They don't speak Ukrainian. But what is important, they consider themselves Ukrainians, and we should value this if we want the country to be as it is, to be one.
We're going to have to bring this to a close. Father will be here for a while. There's some coffee, and we can talk a little bit further in a more careful way. I just wanted to thank you so much.
Thank you.